Okay, Proverbs 21, verse 2. Let's actually read verses 2 and 3 together, and then we'll come back and talk about those. Verse 2. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the hearts. To do righteousness and justice is more acceptable to the Lord than sacrifice. If we are going to please the Lord, has He given us things to do?
Sure.
Old Testament knew there were certain commands that were given under the old law. There are certain commands given now, and He expects us to do them. But if we're going to do them right, where must that obedience come from?
Heart.
It has to. Without the heart, we are wasting our time. And that's the thing that's kind of frightening. You can go through and do all of the commands to the letter. You can do all of these things, but if your heart's not in it, it's vain worship. It's just completely worthless. And we actually see an example. If you'll mark your places in Proverbs, go back to 1 Samuel 15. Remember, God had told King Saul to go and destroy the Amalekites, all of them, to destroy their possessions. And of course, he doesn't do that. He spares King Agag, their ruler. He spares the best of their flocks, and he comes up with reasons and excuses for doing that. Verse 19, let's start there. This is Samuel speaking to him, says, Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul said to Samuel, but I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I've gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me, and I brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites. And that's one of those moments where I just can't help but chuckle to myself. He just told on himself, didn't he? He was supposed to destroy all the Amalekites. What did he say he just did? I brought back King Agag. I've destroyed all the Amalekites. Saul, listen to what you just said. If you brought the king back, what did not happen? You must not have destroyed all of them. There's at least one left. And so he tells on himself there in that very verse. Verse 21, but the people, then of course, he tries to blame someone else. But the people took of the plunder, the sheep and oxen, and the best of things, which should have been utterly destroyed, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. And then 22 is what I want us to see. This is Samuel's answer to him. Has the Lord as great a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? He sort of puts that out there and asks that question. And then he answers it. Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed better than the fat of rams. And he goes on to say, witchcraft is just like the sin of rebellion. To rebel against the Lord, I mean, you might as well go out and worship false gods and practice all these other things. To obey is better than sacrifice. Now we don't want to misunderstand the point he's making. Did God want the sacrifices? Yes, he did. He did. But the whole point here is what God wants first and foremost is obedience. He wants his people to do as he's commanded. And Saul came up with all these great excuses. From a human standpoint, bringing the king back sounds like a good idea. Maybe we could ransom him to someone else, or we could do this. And keeping the best of the flock sounds like a good idea. But God said, don't do any of that. Destroy it. And so when God has given that command, what he wanted was obedience. And Saul, of course, he would not do it. And this is just one of those instances in Saul's life where we see him coming up with a great reason for doing the exact opposite of what God's told him to do. So
we do the same thing. We try to justify ourselves. Yeah. And then when we see that doesn't work, then we try to lay the blame on somebody else.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's doing there. And Steve's right. That can be the same approach that I take too. Yeah, any other thoughts on this session?
Well, it's kind of like the sacrifice without the obedience is kind of like trying to buy your way into God's grace, and it doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
The sacrifice means nothing without the obedience. He wants the sacrifice too, but he's got to have both the sacrifice and the obedience.
Yeah, I think one thing we can forget, unless the point that he brings up is really important, you're not going to buy your way into heaven. There's nothing. What are you going to buy it with? What are you going to give God that he doesn't already have? I mean, we can't do that. I think what we miss is what he really wants, what he's always wanted from the beginning of creation, is that close relationship with his creation. He's always wanted man to be in perfect harmony with Him. That's the way it was in the Garden of Eden until things went south. That's what He wants it to be again. And to do that, it's going to require obedience. The only way can two walk together unless they be agreed? The answer is no. We see that in the Old Testament, and it's true with God. We can't walk with Him unless we be in agreement. And to be in agreement, we got to be honest. He gets to make the rules. I don't get to come up with them. So if I'm going to be in agreement with Him, I'm going to have to obey Him and those things. And then, but the ironic thing is, so many times people will say, well, I don't know why I should have to obey God. He tells me what's best for me anyway. That's the thing. When I obey Him, it's what's best for me. He knows better than I do. Good. Any other thoughts? Yeah, Steve, go ahead.
It's kind of like obedience is the whole. And then you have the sacrifices being a part of that. And then you have the obedience of destroying the Amalekites as part of that, obeying God's will. But it takes all of it to make the whole.
Yeah.
Just like today, we can obey part of God's word, but not the rest of it. So we're not obedient.
That's right. Yeah. It only takes a portion of disobedience to ruin the whole obedience. Yeah, great. Going with this idea, Psalm 51, verses 16 and 17. For you do not desire sacrifice, or else I would give it. You do not delight in burnt offering. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. And again, the point is not that He doesn't want you to do these sacrifices. The point is, it all starts with the heart. It starts with a broken and contrite heart. And when you give Him that, when your heart is willing to submit to His will, then we can be pleasing to Him. And we'll do the other things right, too, because our heart is right. Any other thoughts on that? Good comments. Okay, let's go back to Proverbs 21 then. Pick up in verse 4. Here we have another verse dealing with the problems and the dangers of pride. A haughty look, a proud heart, and the plowing of the wicked are sin. We've talked about it before, so I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this one concerning pride. If our actions are from prideful hearts, they will lead to sin. What is pride? Let's, I guess, talk about that for a second. What is it?
It's lifting oneself up.
Lifting oneself up, right?
Above others. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so why would it be something that God hates? Because He doesn't just dislike it. He doesn't just, I'd rather you didn't do that. He hates it. He absolutely despises pride. Why is that?
Man has no right to be proud of anything, because everything man has, God has given. We're nothing without Him. We can do nothing without Him. And so we have no reason. I mean, He is the proud one.
And putting Les's comment with Bobby's, when we are proud, we forget our place, don't we? I mean, isn't that really the problem? We take ourselves and we put ourselves here, in His place. We seat ourselves on His throne. Can you see why it might upset Him a little bit? When someone is trying to, basically, if I'm proud, I have become the God of my life. And where's that going to lead? Yeah, what a mess. What a mess I will cause with that. And God knows that. He knows the dangers of it. But also, we're denying Him His right and His place as Creator. So, certainly we can see why He hates it. Can you think of any examples of pride in the Bible? Nebuchadnezzar, that's usually the first one that comes to my mind. That certainly he exalted himself. Can you think of any others?
Yeah, we can think of the Pharaoh in Egypt.
Yeah.
Thought that he was God.
Absolutely.
And put himself up there above God. And I think that there are things that we can be proud of.
Sure.
I don't think we wipe out pride being proud totally. But I think the things that we can't be proud of is in our service to the Lord, that we gotta, you know, be on the right level when we are serving God. But certain things we can be proud of, you know, and not feel guilty about it.
Sure. Yeah. You know, when our girls sing without us asking them to, when they sing one of their Bible songs, you think it makes me proud? I'm proud. But it's not proud in the sense that I'm exalting myself. It's I am pleased. It brings me joy. And in that sense, Roy is absolutely right. If you work hard, can you be proud of that work and go to sleep at night pleased? Sure. We're pleased with the work that is done. That, and we use the word proud in that way. That's a whole different ballgame from Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, it wasn't how he treated it. Pharaoh. Roy mentioned Pharaoh, exact same way. We mentioned Saul already. You think Saul had some pride issues? Yeah, that's why the whole thing with David started. It was because of that. So good comments. Anything else you guys want to bring up? Bob, go ahead.
Well, in chapter 23, Christ said, the scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat with the lawgiver.
Yeah.
But it made rules that God didn't make. So before chapter 23 is over, Christ called them blind guys.
By making rules that God hadn't given, what had the Pharisees and Sadducees done to themselves, to their elders, to their rules?
They
put him in the place of God, and that's what we're getting at here. We can see why he hated that so very much. Yeah, Pharisees and Sadducees certainly had pride issues. We've seen that as we've been studying the life of Christ. Good. Well, let's look at verse 5. The plans of the diligent lead surely to plenty, but those of everyone who is hasty surely to poverty. So you've got diligence contrasted with hastiness here. Hardworking and patient diligence leads to blessings. It is something that the Bible encourages and praises. What about impatience and just rushing into stuff? What does the Bible think about that? Someone who does that, someone who frequently rushes in and just gives no thought. I'm trying to think of how to ask this. What kind of problems do they have when they rush in? Where does that come from? Maybe that's the best way to ask it.
We can have all kind of problems doing that because we should take our time and inquire the Lord word to see if we have permission from Him to do what they're thinking about doing.
Yeah. Good. What else?
You don't have clear judgment and you make big mistakes and bad choices and then something goes wrong and you're like, man, I can't believe I did that. I wish I had thought about that.
Yeah. We used to swim in creeks all the time and your parents would tell you, you know, jump in feet first time to make sure there aren't any logs in there. Then, you know, and we always dove in head first because we were 14, you know, and we assume those things. But it's that. Do you think it's tied to self-control, or maybe a lack of self-control is where this goes? I really think those go together. That why is somebody always just so hasty? Why can't they be patient? I think it's because they don't have any self-control, or they choose not to show any self-control. And certainly that's something that we're warned against, Old Testament and New.
But our intentions can be good, and still we can be too hasty. You know, when Christ was being arrested, Peter cut Malchus' ear off, and Christ told him to put his sword up.
Yeah.
But I guess that was the only way Peter knew how to fight at that time.
Yeah, he was hasty. He didn't have any self-control. Can you imagine Peter not having any self-control? I mean, is that new to anybody? he frequently struggled with it. I'm glad Bob brought that up. Is this a problem that good people can struggle with? It really is. I mean, this is a problem that people who love the Lord, we can struggle with this lack of self-control. Peter, you think he loved Jesus?
Yes.
Loved him dearly. He struggled with self-control. And certainly I think he got better with it at over time. He became an elder, and certainly one of those qualifications of an elder is being able to control yourself. So he must have at some point developed that. And it's something for us too. Steve, I think you had a comment?
We're taught to consider the cost.
Yeah. Yeah. count the cost of everything. You know, before somebody goes to battle, goes to war, they plan the cost. Before somebody builds a tower, they plan the cost. They consider what's going to be involved in it. And we should do that with all of our decisions. Good. Any other thoughts? Okay, good. Let's see. That's kind of along the same lines. Let's go with 6 and 7. Verse 6, getting treasures by a lying tongue is the fleeting fantasy of those who seek death. I've always liked Proverbs, but as we've been studying it, just read the verse again, especially the second half. Getting treasures by a lying tongue is the fleeting fantasy of those who seek death. That's just incredible. Just to see the wisdom that's being brought out there. Some think they can make their fortune through dishonesty, and that's what's being addressed here. Those who think they can get treasures by a lying tongue, they can deceive others and get rich off of it. What is it? What is it really? It seems like a get-rich-quick scheme that is going to be great, but what is it?
Bottom line is death.
It's death. It is spiritual death is where it leads. And just that whole description, being rich is their fantasy. It is their great desire. But what it really is spiritual suicide. They are seeking death for themselves. And I do believe this is especially talking about spiritual death. May lead to physical death too. You rip off the wrong person. That's dangerous in a physical sense. It is certainly dangerous spiritually. So you got that one here in verse 6. Look at verse 7. The violence of the wicked will destroy them because they refuse to do justice. These are those who seek to get ahead by doing harm to others. I mean, this is violence being done to others. I know, I'm sure there are some, and Alan could probably tell me better than any. I'm sure there were some outlaws who managed to end up living peaceful lives and die of old age. But I can't imagine there were a whole bunch of them. You know, the names that you think of, the Dillingers and the Bugsy Siegels and Babyface Nelsons and all these guys, it didn't end well for them. They lived by violence. How did they die? All of those guys I mentioned, I'm pretty sure were gunned down. That's how it came to end. That stuff comes back and that stuff is reflected. And, you know, that idea of live by the sword, die by the sword, and it does follow suit. Okay, any thoughts on any of these? And if I'm wrong on any of those guys, Alan will tell me later, I know. But
very few of them live to be old age.
Yeah, you know. You would think if a lot of them had made it to old age, they would have developed enough sense to tell the younger guys to stop doing it.
Yeah.
You know, this is, okay, I made it to old age. That doesn't normally happen. You need to find another career choice. So it's just, we see it. We see the destruction that comes with that.
Another thing about verse 6, most people don't believe that they will lose their spiritual soul by a lying tongue.
Yeah.
You know, getting treasure, you know, they talk about getting treasure with a lying tongue. You know, we see today that a lot of people do that, and they don't think that they will lose their soul for doing that, and so they continue to do it, you know, because they don't think there's no punishment for it.
Yeah. You know, I really do think that we as a people often rank sins and we say, well, you know, I lied about that, but I mean, you know, I mean, it's...
Yeah, like just you use a little win and then be like, it's okay because it was just a little win.
Yeah, it's just, how does God see them?
He does not like it at all.
It's sin. He sees it as sin. And I'm afraid sometimes we may be afraid to say that, to use that word, sin. You know, we kind of tap dance around it. Well, I didn't really lie. I just kind of stretched the truth. What are you talking about? It's the same thing. And this is something that, you know, our society does. Let's take sin and water it down as much as possible and make it as acceptable to everyone. We need to be careful as Christians that sin never gets to the point that it does not offend us. It should offend you when someone lies to you. It should. Why?
It offends God.
Because it offends God. You know, for the same reason that it should offend you when somebody walks up and tries to mug you in town. It's offensive to God. It's wrong. It's wrong according to His laws. It should be wrong according to me and my sensibilities as well. Okay, good. Verse 8. The way of a guilty man is perverse, but as for the pure, his work is right. What does perverse mean?
Crooked.
Crooked, yeah. That may be just the best way to describe it. Crooked, twisted, evil. That's what a perverse way is. It says the way of a guilty man is perverse. He will quickly develop a reputation for wickedness. Those who chase after those things. But let's look at the light side, the second part of this verse. As for the pure, his work is right. What is the pure-hearted man's path like? What's his work like? It's good. It's clean. It's pure. How do you think he sleeps at night? He has harmed no one. He has done wrong to no one. Now again, does this mean that no trouble will ever come his way?
No.
This means it probably will. Because if he tries to do God's ways, always, you're going to offend somebody. But it'll be okay. It will be. We will be fine. And certainly God will he'll watch out for us in this. Good. Okay. Let's look at verse 9 along with 19. Better to dwell in the corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman. Verse 19. Better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman. What is contentious? What does that mean?
Quarrelsome.
There you go. Yeah, quarrelsome. Constantly stirring up trouble there. What do contentions do in a home?
Breed strife.
Yeah. Okay. They can create a rift between the members of that family. It's just this anger that's kind of bubbling underneath, and it's just always there, just pulling away. It can cause a rift between husband and wife. Does that lead to any problems? Yeah, I mean, just on and on and on. You can just run with that. That what starts with contentions can absolutely tear a marriage apart completely. What about for kids? What kind of example, if they live in a home that is full of contention, full of quarrel, what effect does that have on the kids? Yeah, you know, if I show them that all the time, how are they going to think problems are solved?
Through fighting and arguing.
Through screaming. Yeah. That they're going to see what they see and think that, well, I mean, this is the way I saw it. We have to be very careful with this sort of thing.
It destroys them too, you know, in their little, like, it destroys their little heart and their mind. You know, they don't understand and they think, well, you know, am I supposed to feel this angry and sad all the time because that's how my parents are? And then they don't know any other, you know, any other. When they grow up, that's all they know.
Yeah, and think about that. What should the home be like for them, especially emotionally? What kind of place should it be?
Loving and caring.
Place of safety and love and peace. And if it's not, then God's plan for the home is already messed up. So certainly, it's going to have a negative effect on the children, but not just them, everybody who's part of that place. And let's just look at it in another sense. If there's constantly contentions, what about the husband's place as leader in the home? Do you think that's going to be respected?
No.
You think that's going to be treated the way God intended? It's not. It's not going to happen. So it just affects so many, many different aspects. You know, we talked about this a little bit Friday night in the class. You want to ruin a family? Complain and stir up trouble. You want to ruin a family? That'll do it. You want to ruin a local church? Complain and stir up trouble. That's the way to do it. This stuff, Satan knows this, and he plants those seeds, and a lot of times, unfortunately, we can take them and run with them. So these are things, contentions and complaining and just stirring the pot. Don't do that stuff. It's never good. Any thoughts, any comments on those two verses, 9 and 19? Yeah, go ahead, Matt.
You kind of just mentioned it. I think there's application we're talking about family in the home, but I think there's spiritual family application of this verse to kind of just tie it in.
You know, I think the first observation, or the first realization, maybe a better way to say it, is we don't just come together on Sundays and hang out for an hour or two. This is a spiritual family. There is a bond between us through the shed blood of Christ that is unlike any other. It is special. So how should we treat each other?
type of family.
Yeah, I mean, that's how God expects it to be. Our job toward each other should be building each other up and helping each other get to heaven. If you and I are constantly quarreling, how's that working out? Anybody feel like they're being helped on the way to heaven if you're constantly fighting and fussing and gnashing and just, what is the verse in I believe it's in Galatians that talks about lest you devour one another. Well, that's what happens. You end up eating each other alive and just ruining that. So, very hard to build each other up when you're tearing each other down. I know that sounds obvious, but people do it all the time. So certainly, Matt's application is right. That spiritual family, we need to be there and be the lights and the encouragement for each other that we should. Good. Any other thoughts on Bobby? Go ahead.
You know, I don't think they didn't need to feel bad because it said woman, because some men are same way, like arguing.
Some people love it. They love it. And I don't know. I know people who feel that way. I don't know why. Because when I look at them, they enjoy it. And they're some of the most miserable people. They just make themselves miserable, but yet they continue to do it. And that's just one of those things. We can get caught in this vicious cycle. How do you get out of it? God's the only way we're going to get out of it. Because if we keep doing what we've been doing, we're going to keep doing what we've been doing. So we've got to turn and we've got to stop at some point and repent. Matt, go ahead.
I was just going to say that Jamie kind of alluded to this. I think those people, it traces back now to their home is part of it. And maybe a lot of those people saw that as children. That's all they saw and that's all they knew was contention. And that's kind of how they grew up. And, you know, that's becomes, as a Christian, becomes a weakness and one of your difficulties to overcome. Of that feeling, and because it's all you knew growing up.
I think two things help with that. I think studying to see what God has said, what God's pattern for the home is, helps. And I think the other thing is surrounding yourselves by people who are doing it right. You know, it's good examples of godly Christian families doing it the right way. I need to see that. I need to see them doing it right, because that'll help me say, you know, I need to do more of this. And this is just one more reason that we spend time together, we're around each other. But absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead, Lynn.
As you grow up and you become responsible for yourself, and you don't have to follow those footsteps.
You don't.
It is a choice to make.
Absolutely.
And you can only blame parents so long, and then eventually you have to learn to stand on your own feet and make your choices and your decisions.
That was the question I was going to ask. Do we have to do it that way just because we were brought up in it? No, we do not. We do not have to do that.
I don't think we'll see it, though, unless we do like 2 Corinthians 13:5 says, a self-examination.
Yeah. And that's the way with every sin. We can blind ourselves to it until we force ourselves to take an honest look. Good. Okay, let's go to verse 11. I'm sorry, verse 10. The soul of the wicked desires evil. His neighbor finds no favor in his eyes. You know, the wicked has no mercy toward his neighbor. We see that in this verse. I think this is easy to sum up. If I am unmerciful toward others, what can I expect? They're not going to be merciful toward me. Now, what can I expect from God? He's not going to be merciful either. So, I mean, that one's easy for me. You know, if you treat others without mercy, it's coming back. It's coming back now by your neighbors, and it's certainly coming back at judgment, that he will not be merciful on those who have been unmerciful. So, don't want to skip through that verse quickly, but I think it's a pretty easy one, really. Anything else you want to bring up on it? Okay, let's look at 11 then. When the scoffer is punished, the simple is made wise. When the wise is instructed, he receives knowledge. So let's look at the first part of that. When the scoffer, those, you know, we've talked about scoffers before. Scoffers are those who especially when it comes to God's ways, they look at it and they scoff. They say, they have no use for God's ways. When the scoffer is punished, the simple is made wise. So you have someone who is naive. He is ignorant. He is uninstructed. Can you fix ignorance?
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Ignorance is a lack of knowledge. You fix that by applying knowledge. We've talked about this before. There's a difference between ignorance and stupidity. Right? Ignorance is, I don't have the knowledge. But when it comes, I'm no longer ignorant. Stupidity is, the knowledge is all around me. I just don't what? I don't care. I don't want it. Yeah, that's the difference between those two is a heart. It's a heart issue. Continuing to do what's wrong just because I'm hard-headed. That's a heart problem. The wise, so the simple, here the admonition is, when those who scoff at God's ways are punished, the naive, the simple can see it and learn from it. So that's a good thing. But what about the wise? When they are corrected or when they're instructed, what happens to them?
They learn from it.
Yeah, they want it. They actually want the knowledge to come because they want to get better. They want to grow and get stronger. So you see, that's the polar opposite of the scoffer who just refuses to hear it. The wise want it, and then they'll make whatever changes are necessary. Good. Verse 12. The righteous God wisely considers the house of the wicked, overthrowing the wicked for their wickedness. Depending on your translation here, I think the Old King James says that the righteous wisely considers the house of the wicked. The New King James says the righteous God. Either point is valid. You can make a point for either one. God, who is absolutely righteous, does He see the house of the wicked? He sees everything. Everything that goes on in it. Everything that takes place there. And what's more, He's not going to allow the wickedness to go unpunished. If it's not repented of, then those who perform it will have to answer for it. He is patient sometimes. And I think for us, we can get a little frustrated. We see evil being done by a person and they seem to be getting away with it. And we say, Lord, why? Why are you allowing this to happen? What if God had punished Saul of Tarsus in the midst of him persecuting Christians? What would we have never had? You'd never read about Paul the Apostle. Did Paul the Apostle do some good for the Lord's kingdom? Man, what a worker. What a man who loved God. And yet God was long-suffering. You know, and I think we've talked about this before. I imagine there were some Christians that were thinking, Lord, why are you letting this Saul of Tarsus live? He is just wreaking havoc on us. Well, why? What did God know that all of those other folks, and you and I, if we were there, most likely wouldn't have known? I would have been talking about it. We got to do something about Saul. This is crazy. What did God know? He's misled. He does want truth. He's ignorant. Can ignorance be fixed? When truth comes, it can fix ignorance. God knew that. I wouldn't have known that. I would have just sat there and been mad. Every time I saw Saul dragging people down the street, I would have just... And we might have even hated him. And yet, God loved him. And He gave him time. And He knew things that I wouldn't have been able to see. You know, there's a lesson for that in us. Why doesn't God strike immediately when the evil's done? Because He's long-suffering. I'm glad He didn't strike me the first time I did evil. He's patient. So let's... Just remember, He knows. He knows more than we do, and He knows better than us. Good. Now that's God seeing the house. Can we, as the righteous, see the house of the wicked as well? Yeah, we can see that and realize that God is going to overthrow it, and that should motivate us to make sure our house is not that house. Make sure that we're doing those things that are pleasing to Him. Good. Any comments on anything so far?
You know, if God had dealt with mankind in that way, there will be very few people on the earth today. You know, when you first did something wicked or you continue to do something wicked, then everybody would have been struck down. And God knew that. That's why Jesus came to save us from that fate. Because at one time, you know, another, all of us have done things that are wicked.
Yeah.
And didn't realize that it was wicked.
God desires all men to be saved. He wants that. Now, He is aware that that's not going to happen. I mean, he's not. It doesn't mean that all men are going to be saved, but God wants everyone to come to Him. And again, just trying to kind of wrap my head around that hopefully will help me to be more long-suffering. Doesn't mean we're tolerant of sin in the sense that we say, well, you know, if it's okay for them to do it, I can do it. It's not that. And it's never that. But if I love their souls, what do I want for them? Yeah, I want them to be saved too. And maybe that's my problem. Maybe I need to be better at loving souls and love them more the way God does. Now, I am going to address a side point to this because justice does need to be done. And this is something that God has always expected. You know, I mean, you can go back to Genesis and see that when man sheds another man's blood, God requires blood from him. I mean, this is one of those things that we can't just sit around and turn a blind eye to evil, because even if we want people to be saved. I just say that because God does expect justice to be done, and I need to understand that and want that too. But at the same time, I need to do everything I can to help others see truth and to care about their souls enough to teach them. I'm afraid one of the reasons we don't teach the gospel to others like we should is we just don't care about them enough. You know, we just don't care about them enough. And I don't think we'd ever come out and say it. But if I never tell my neighbor about the blood that was shed for him, do I really love them? If I'm just letting them just keep on living and just go on into hell, how can I stand at judgment and say, oh, I hate it worked out for you like that, but I sure do love you. I never said it. What's the song, "You Never Mentioned Him to Me"? I love that song and I hate it at the same time because it makes me feel like dirt every time we sing it. Because how many people do I come in contact with? Never do I mention. And in the accusation against me, I can talk to them about Star Wars, complete stranger. I can talk to them about video games and Target. I had a 30-minute conversation with somebody I'd never met before. Now, how can I do that and not mention Jesus to them? What's wrong with me? If I love Him, I will. And it's, you know, it's something I have to be better at. I think it would probably apply to more than me. Okay, let's look at one more. Actually, any other thoughts on this? I don't want to skip ahead if you got something else. Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
The example you just made is, I think, a perfect example for all of us to look at. You know, we're quick to say that there's no such thing as a little sin. But when we stray just enough to be disobedient to God's will, we transgress. And when we and we, believe it or not, in our own righteous way of saying that, oh, you know, I'm not so bad because that guy next door, I really don't care to be bothered. That is not God's will. So those are the little things, those are the little cracks that we fall in. We don't find ourselves making the major mistakes, but those little bitty cracks are the ones that are going to condemn us on the day of reckoning. And I think that's what we as Christians need to be aware of.
Yeah.
And it is so good. I think we all need to put ourselves in the boat with Peter. Peter being the individual that he was. But see, God knew Peter's heart. And Jesus prayed for Peter. And in the end, Peter became one of the leaders of God's people. He became a shepherd of God's people. And he couldn't do that until he corrected all the errors in his life.
You know, the Apostle Peter is one of the best examples for me. Because he's one I can relate to. You know, we always talk about, well, how can we relate to this or relate to that? I can relate to Peter. You know, opening my mouth and inserting my foot before I think about what I'm saying. Yeah, that's happened. That's happened. And just acting because I'm just kind of flared up over something, that's happened. I can I can see Peter's actions. Every time I read them, you know, you say, oh, don't do it, don't do it. Don't tell Jesus not to die. Don't say it, Peter. But he does, because he just acts. And I'm glad we have his example, because Joe's right. He did get better. He fixed those. Even after he was an apostle, he makes mistakes toward the Gentiles, and Paul has to correct him. So it doesn't mean that Peter became perfect, even when he was an apostle and an elder, but we always see him repenting. That's an example for me. If I make a mistake and I see it and realize, what do you do about it? I just man up and admit it and fix it. And that's what Peter did. And I just appreciate that example so very much. One other point that Joe mentioned that is really, I think, extremely important. We can, in our minds, categorize things as just being, oh, this is just a little thing, it's not a big deal. Matthew 25, the differences in what they did, like when he's describing the differences between the sheep and the goats. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but in verse 36, he's talking to those who are the sheep, those who are faithful to him. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. And the righteous, you know, they answer and say, when did we do these things for you? When you did it to those who were in need, you did it unto me. These are not big things, really. I mean, it's not like slaying a dragon here. This is, I was naked and you clothed me. How much effort does that really take? I mean, if we're conscious and we see that need, how difficult is it to clothe somebody in need? In the world we live in, with the plenty we have, do you have any extra clothes that you could clothe somebody with? Could you do that today? Sure we could. That's not a big deal. I was sick and you visited me. Can you visit somebody? Can we do that? Yeah, I mean, we can. These are not difficult things. But then go down to the goats. Then he will say to those on the left, the goats, verse 41, depart from me, you cursed, into the everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, you did not take me in. I was naked, you did not clothe me. Yeah, you know, these guys didn't go out and murder people. They didn't go out and steal from people. They just didn't do these little things. And they did it under Christ that same way. Or they, in this case, did not do it. So I just think it's a good point that Joe brings out there. Go ahead, Bob.
Verse 36 of Matthew 25. He said, I was in prison. You don't really have to be in a state prison. You could be in a prison of sin.
Yeah.
And nobody gets you out.
What a great... great application. Sin is bondage. And if I know that somebody is in bondage of sin, can I go to them and visit them and try to help them out of it? And not only can I must. That's something that he's expecting of his people. Good thoughts. Any other comments? I think it's probably a good verse to end on. Okay, we'll stop there. Thank you, guys.